Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Hi, I'm Mark Thiemens. I'm Dean of Physical Sciences at UC San Diego, and I have the pleasure today of interviewing and asking questions of Marvin, a.k.a. Murph Goldberger, who's Dean Emeritus of the Division of Physical Sciences at UC San Diego, my predecessor, who also has been the president of Caltech, the head of the Institute of Advanced Studies at Princeton University, and a professor at the University of Chicago, plus having served on the Presidential Science Advisory Committee. Murph was educated in the 1940s. His undergraduate degree was before World War II. He was involved with the Manhattan Project, and afterwards got his PhD working with arguably one of the greatest physicists of all time, Enrico Fermi, at the University of Chicago. Through that time period, which is the late 40s, 50s, and 60s, is arguably one of the more important parts of development of science and education and policy related to such things in the United States. What was it like in the 40s and 50s for science in the U.S.? What was happening?
It was marvelous. The scientists had won the war. When I say the war, I mean, of course, World War II, with the combination of radar and nuclear weapons. It was a wonderful time, and not only were there lots of jobs, but a lot of the instrumentation that had been developed during the war led the way to a period of immense excitement in physics, particularly in the field that I was interested in, which was so-called elementary particle physics. I went and became a postdoctoral person at the radiation laboratory at the University of California. Radiation laboratory was headed by Ernest Lawrence, Nobel laureate, man who invented the cyclotron. So it was just a marvelous scene at that time. It was customary for people to take a couple of years of postdoc, and after a year at Berkeley, I ended up at MIT as a postdoc in 1949. I'll tell you one amusing aspect of that. The society in Cambridge is very highly structured. If you are a professor at Harvard, you're at the very top of the list. If you're a postdoc at MIT, you could not be possibly lower. And even though there are many departments at MIT that were better than those at Harvard, they would have all killed to have gotten those positions at Harvard. I was offered an assistant professorship at Harvard in a manner by which means I've never been able to figure out. About a week after that announcement, I got an offer to go to Chicago, and I accepted it over the phone. The people at Harvard were somewhat skeptical about the exact whereabouts of Chicago, and at any rate, it was obvious it must have been inferior to Harvard, but it was the smartest thing I ever did, as it turns out.
Well, it was an amazing collection of people at Chicago at the time. What was it like going there and subsequent to that in later years?
Well, it was a tremendous place. There were all sorts of great people. Joan Maria Mayer, who ultimately came out here to UCSD, Fermi, Edward Teller, Chandrasekhar, the great astrophysicist. It was just extraordinary collection of people with widely varying interests and quite exciting. I came out here in the summer of 1956. There was a study which ultimately was the basis for the formation of General Atomics, which is still alive here in La Jolla. And I had met Roger Revell, and Roger had been thinking actively about trying to have a branch of the University of California here in La Jolla. And he asked me if I would come and work on that with him. But just before we had come out here in that summer of 56, I had accepted a job at Princeton, and I felt I could not give that up. It was a position that was later filled by a man named Keith Bruckner, who was a close personal friend, someone I had been involved with in a variety of ways over the years, who came here and made a tremendous contribution to this university in recruiting not people just in the sciences. Keith was a theoretical physicist, but in all parts he was, I think he was nominally called the vice chancellor when the university came into being. And he's a person whose contributions to UCSD have not been recognized to the degree that I think would be appropriate.
Well, Murph, starting a university is no trivial task. How much of it was Revell and the settings at the time and where things were in science?
He was dedicated to the idea of bringing a University of California campus to this area. And he worked very hard at that. For example, at that time, people who were Jewish could not own property in the city of La Jolla. Roger went to the city fathers and he said, this has got to stop if you're going to have a university here. And he broke that covenant single-handedly, to the best of my knowledge.
You had mentioned a few moments ago that Roger had come to get you to come to San Diego, and you had already confirmed that you were going to Princeton and didn't want to back out on that. I'd heard there's a number of other quite famous people beside yourself that he had tried to recruit but wasn't successful. Or can you think of any?
Well, Keith Bruckner actually came up with a grandiose scheme to hire Murray Gell-Mann, who went on to win the Nobel Prize in Physics, Francis Lowe, a very distinguished theoretical physicist who was at MIT, Ken Watson, who was at Wisconsin at the time, I think, or maybe at Berkeley, Jeffrey Chu, he was at Berkeley, and me. And if he had pulled it off, it would have been quite a coup. And of course, a tremendous lift to the physics department at UCSD. I did play a role in some of the hiring that took place here, even though I wasn't here. Norman Kroll, who had been an old friend of mine, and he came. And the same is true of Walter Cohn, who came at about the same time as Norman. Walter Cohn later went on to win a Nobel Prize in chemistry. I found somewhat surprising that the chemist would do it, because he was really a physicist.
Right.
But it was a combination of timing and the circumstances that led to the possibility of doing a lot of first-class recruiting here.
So UCSD gets started, and we have a first chancellor, Herb York.
Well, let me say a few words about that. He was a protege of Ernest Lawrence. Lawrence, during the war, took him to Oak Ridge, where Lawrence was in charge of a particular facility for enriching uranium. Brought him back, was his mentor as a graduate student. And the price that Herb paid for that is, although he was quite successful as a physicist and did a couple of very important experiments at the radiation lab, when Lawrence said, I want you to be the director of Livermore, he almost couldn't refuse.
Right.
And I've often wondered what would have happened to Herb had he not been such a protege that he felt he couldn't say no. He did, of course, spectacularly well in the thing that he was asked to do, not just at Livermore, building that laboratory from scratch, but he went on to become a very important figure in the whole set of issues associated with nuclear weapons and their control. And so, in many ways, the world is perhaps somewhat better off because he did choose to take that responsibility on It was a branch point in his life that changed discreetly and forever. He could not go back to being a physicist.
You were here in the 1950s. What would you think La Jolla and San Diego would be like if UCSD didn't exist? Do you think we've had an influence on the community of San Diego in terms of what it's become?
I think that's true, Mark. And, you know, there's a sort of a chicken and egg problem here. UCSD was here. We had people on our faculty, some of whom went out and started companies. I think the presence of people like that that did come and start companies from academic backgrounds played an important role. I mean, one has Irwin Jacobs and Qualcomm, another guy, Andy Viterbi, who was sort of the co-inventor of Qualcomm, both of whom have been very important influences on the evolution of science and technology in the San Diego area. So I do believe that we've played a very important role.
Well, Murph, I think we're probably about out of time, but I thank you and appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Next up, UC San Diego algae expert Stephen Mayfield and the promise of algal biofuels.
We're here with Stephen Mayfield, our newest professor of biology here at UCSD. Now, Steve is the director of SDCAB, which stands for the San Diego Center for Algae Biotechnology, and he's also an algae expert. In fact, he's been called an algae guru by one of the local papers in town, having spent the last 22 years at the Scripps Research Institute studying algae. Steve, welcome.
Thanks, Kim. Thanks for having me out.
Now, Steve, what is the interest in algae? It's the stuff that we usually want to get rid of in our swimming pools.
Yeah, that's right. Most people spend most of their energy trying to get this out of their swimming pools and bird baths. The interest in it, I think, comes from a couple of different things. One, there's certainly been a big push over the last few years to go to green technologies, and algae is the original green technology. And by green technologies, what we mean is renewable, sustainable, environmentally friendly. And what we're learning to do, here at UC San Diego, is to train these guys to do a few things they haven't done before. One will be to make biofuels, and there's certainly a huge interest now because of in bioenergy and in getting sustainable energy for this country.
So we already have some sort of biofuel that we're pumping into gas right now, ethanol from corn.
That's right.
How do you compare the two? Is algae biofuels going to be something that's going to be better, cheaper than ethanol?
Well, so it'll be different in a couple of really important ways. The first way is that the fuel that we get from algae is what we call fungible fuel. That means it's a direct replacement for the petroleum we use now. So the fuels we'll derive from algae will be diesel, will be gasoline, and will be jet fuel. So ethanol is not any of those. Ethanol, it's alcohol, it's ethyl alcohol. And that we can add to fuels, and we do right now at about 5%. But as soon as you go above 5%, they have an unwanted characteristic in that they bring water along with them. And when they do that, that completely changes the way your engine runs. It causes them to rust. The other thing is that they're lower energy density. So ethanol only has about 70% of the energy on a per gallon basis. So the fuels we make from algae will be exact replacements of what we're already making right now.
So I understand algae biofuels also have some other advantages over ethanol. The fact that you can actually grow them, which might much greater density, for example, and they don't emit as much carbon into the atmosphere. Is that right?
Correct? So one of the things when we started to make biofuel from corn, from ethanol, right? Originally, people always assumed, well, since that carbon is captured by photosynthesis, that must mean that these are carbon-neutral fuels, meaning the amount of carbon that you release when you burn it is exactly equivalent to the amount of carbon that was taken out of the atmosphere when you grew the fuel. And that's true, but you have to do something which we call a life cycle analysis, and that's you have to measure all the energy in. So when we're talking about corn ethanol, it's not just the energy to grow the corn, it's also the energy to take that corn, to transport it to a distillery, the energy it takes to ferment the corn into ethanol and then to distill the ethanol off the water, that actually uses a huge amount of energy. So when you add all those things together, right, that's when you come up with what we call the life cycle analysis or the true carbon footprint. So in ethanol from corn, that turned out not to be very good. In fact, it turned out to require almost as much energy to produce the ethanol from corn that you actually got out of burning the ethanol. So it was almost the same as just using petroleum. In algae, our initial life cycle analysis say that we're about 60 to 70% reduction in that carbon utilization. So they look to be much better than ethanol.
And it's also true that you can grow algae in a lot of different places that you can't grow higher plants. For example, you can grow it in high ceiling environments out
That's
in the
right.
desert.
That's right. So one of the big advantages on this is that we're not going to displace existing agricultural land. So we are not going to have to go to Iowa and displace any corn or soybeans. Right? We're going to grow this in the deserts. We're going to grow this in wastelands. We're going to grow this out in the Imperial Valley near the Salton Sea where nothing chooses to grow anymore. And that's because algae has actually adapted to these very hostile environments. It spent the last couple billion years surviving in places where other organisms didn't want to, and we can take advantage of that evolution.
And also, algae can make use of a lot of nutrients that actually we're using or dumping out into the water system great quantities, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So one of the requirements for any photosynthetic organism is not only that we have sunlight and CO2, but we also need two very important nutrients. We need nitrogen and we need phosphate. And right now, all of our municipal wastewater that we dump out into the ocean or we pump back into the ground, we never pull that nitrogen and phosphate out of it. It's actually loaded with that. Now, when we take those and pump them out into the ocean, that's actually a pollutant in the ocean. So there are actually dead zones outside of every major city in the world where we are killing the ocean. And we're doing that because we're dumping water loaded with the nutrients that are required for algae. There is no reason to do that. And in the very near future, I believe all of our municipal wastewater is going to be pumped through algae ponds because that'll pull the nitrogen and the phosphate out of it, cleans the water up before we release it, and then we'll actually have the benefit of that we don't have to add artificial fertilizers to it. We're just going to take the nitrogen and phosphate that's already there.
Algae actually produce gasoline or oil-like substances. Why is that?
When any photosynthesis takes place in an organism, they're always making a decision on where they're going to divert that energy. So they can put that energy into sugar, they can put that energy into hydrocarbons or lipids, or they can put that energy into proteins. So it's the hydrocarbons and the lipids that algae make, and they've just biologically decided that's what they're going to do for their storage. Mm-hmm. So that's how they store their energy. And that energy stored in hydrocarbons or in lipids can easily be converted to gasoline or diesel or jet fuel.
Hmm. So what kind of algae are the best kinds to actually make algal biofuels? The stuff that you have bubbling right behind you, is that one example?
So that's one example. Yeah. So that happens to be a eukaryotic green algae. That one's called Chlamydomonas. It's sort of our favorite little lab rat.
And eukaryotic means what?
When we talk about algae, most of us, and we look at things that grow out in the water, there are actually two forms of that. One is prokaryotic, that's bacteria, and the other is eukaryotic, and eukaryotic means more sophisticated. So you and I are eukaryotes, plants are eukaryotes, dogs are eukaryotes. Bacteria are not, they're prokaryotic. So these are eukaryotic algae, the little guy growing behind me, and those naturally accumulate very high levels of fat, of lipid. So they naturally make large amounts of things that we can turn into biofuel. We don't know yet which one we're going to use. So there's a couple of things that we have to identify. The best ones are going to be ones that grow fast, that produce large amounts of fat, and that are resistant to being eaten by all the little predators out there who want to come along and eat you. And so that's part of the discovery process.
Now, you're also working with an algae farm out in the Imperial Valley. What exactly are you doing there? And can you take us through why maybe this region might be a good place to grow algae for biofuels?
Yeah, so the requirements for growing algae are obviously you'd like it to be warm. You'd like there to be lots of sunlight out there. And then it helps if you have open land that isn't very expensive. So here, actually on the coast at San Diego, we don't have very many of those good attributes. But not too far from here is the Imperial Valley, and it's really good. So the temperature is obviously warm out there. It's almost a desert, so there's a lot of sunlight out there. There's a fair amount of water. Now, it's not high-quality potable water that we can drink. It's high in salt. The Salton Sea is there. That's full of salt. But algae are perfectly capable of growing salt water. So it turns out to be a very good environment. Now, there's a research facility that we have out there. It's in a little city called Nyland, and we have several large-scale ponds. Now, the point of those ponds is not to go into production per se, but to take the strains that we're developing here in the lab and get them out in the real world and see how they do in what could be a commercial setting. Because once we put them out there, different things happen than happen in the lab. The sunlight's much brighter out there than it is here. There are predators that come in there and want to eat our guys. And so what it is that's a commercial type research facility.
So what do you mean by the predators that are in the ponds right there?
You know, if you just go and plant a tomato plant out in your backyard, you'll know that there are insects that come and eat the tomatoes. There are fungus that attacks that. There are bacteria that get onto that. So all of those things are predators. They're all trying to eat your tomato plant. And the exact same thing happens in algae. And in fact, in algae ponds, there's little animals called rotifers that fly around on little wings and gobble up everything that come through. There's another insect called the daphnia, or some people call it water flea. And these are just fantastic little monsters.
And I understand that you've recently discovered that there are different kinds of algae that do well at different times of the year out there. You've even gotten a version of winter wheat, like winter algae out there.
Yeah, so biofuels produced from algae are going to very much look like agriculture, right? That is that we will actually have crop rotation. So one season we will have one type of algae in there, and that might be our summer algae, and then we'll have a different algae that grows there in the winter. Certainly temperature impacts these things, sunlight impacts them, predators impact them. There's going to be times when predators are going to attack a pond and kill it, and we're just going to have to put a new different strain in, a different species in that's resistant to that predator. So there definitely will be crop rotation involved in this.
Where are scientists right now in developing algae specifically for biofuels?
So the two big challenges that we have, one of them, of course, is biologic. You know, we need to produce, these fuels at very high concentration in the algae. But the main one is economic, and that is we have to learn to go to scale. We burn about 150 billion gallons of gasoline every year in this country. That's an enormous number. So if we're really going to make a dent in that, if we are really going to take biofuels and impact the amount of fuel that we use in this country, it's a very large number. So going to scale, that's something we've never done before. That's something we've never done before in biofuels. We've done it in American agriculture. We have about 100 million acres of corn. We have about 50 million acres of soybean. We think that we could replace most of the liquid fuels required in this country with about 30 to 40 million acres of algae. So that's a big number, but it's a number that we think we can deal with.
How long will it take to develop algae as biofuels, and how much does it cost right now, and can we really expect this to be in our pumps in the next 10 years or so?
It depends who you ask. I think we'll have something launched in the next 2 to 3 years. There will be pilot plants out there that are growing algae, that are producing fuels from them, that we're driving cars, that we're flying airplanes on. But of course, it'll be a very small scale compared to the amount of fuel we actually use in this country.
But right now, algae is fairly expensive if you want to put it in your tank. You can make it right now, but it's fairly expensive. How much per gallon?
Right now, the estimates range from about $10 per gallon up to about $50 or $60 per gallon. And that's a pretty big number. That's not something you or I would want to pay to put into our cars right now. But as a scientist, whenever I look at a problem and I say, oh, I only have to make a tenfold improvement in it, that's pretty easy to do biologically. So if we're at something like $10 or $20 per gallon now and we can make a fivefold improvement in that, then we're competitive with petroleum, with fossil fuel. And we think we can achieve that in the next 3 to 5 years.
So now corn ethanol had a lot of promises when it came out, and now we're starting to discover that it has some problems.
Right.
Are we painting too rosy a picture of algal biofuels, or are we getting ahead of ourselves?
There's a cautionary tale that we got from ethanol. You know, it looked really good coming out the door. It's like, wow, this will create jobs for farmers. We can blend this in our gasoline, right? And it's only when the industry became a little more mature that we began to look at these things. So we want to be careful as we develop these things in algae. Now, certainly, if we just sit down and take a pencil and paper and draw out, you know, the energy inputs and the energy outputs, algae looks much, much better than corn. Everything we know about it so far says that it's going to be much better than corn from a greenhouse gas perspective. However, I do, you know, like you, I read the paper and I watch the news and I see some outrageous claims from algae, things that certainly are not true. But I think the industry's been around long enough that some very sober minds have taken a look at this. We've had a couple of years to start to measure real numbers. There are a number of companies out there now. Sapphire Energy, which I'm a founder of, they now have several hundred acres down in New Mexico, 40 acres under production. General Atomics, Solazyme. There are a number of companies, commercial companies out there, that have been out long enough and started to produce real data, and it's still looking pretty good. We have to get the cost down. We have to learn to go to very large scale. But if we do those two things, I'd say it's looking very good for us.
So algae is really the growth plan of the future.
Yeah, you know, what I tell people is I think that it's going to be the new agriculture. We have a very good history in this country of agriculture, of the developments we put into it, of the efficiencies we brought to it. And, we produce enough food here to feed ourselves, and we export a huge amount to the rest of the world. You know, thank God we do, because that keeps large parts of the third world alive, you know, when they're having famines and the likes. And I think algae has an opportunity to come right along with that. It can be the new corn and the new soybean.
Wow. So pond scum can actually save the world then?
Yeah, I don't know. On its own, I don't know if it's going to save the world. But I think it can change the world in a positive way. I think it's an opportunity that we have ignored. We've been eating algae for thousands of years, right? We've known it's been out there, and we've ignored it. Part of the reasons we ignored it is because there wasn't a requirement before for it. Petroleum was abundant. Our food was abundant. But, you know, there's more than 6 billion of us on this planet now. We're frankly running out of resources. And so every opportunity we have that brings new resources to the table, we have to take advantage of those. And right now, this is the best new resource we have out there. We have to spend some time. We have to do some research. We have to do some development, some engineering development, some biological, some regulatory development, right? These are changing times, and we're going to have to digest those. And it's going to be a little bit painful sometimes. It's going to take a little longer than we hoped. But it's a brand new resource. It's a new energy resource. It's a new food resource. It's a new economic resource. And I think all of those things are really driving it to be the new technology and to make San Diego the green Houston.
Wow. Well, that's an optimistic future. And I thank you for being here. And thanks for and good luck with your research here at UCSD.
Thanks, Kim. We all need it.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.